Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this March the 30th on the West Coast, now March the 31st on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zones. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and I trust that you are going to enjoy tonight's show. Since I hadn't booked a guest for tonight intentionally, I thought it would be a good opportunity to continue along the lines of what I did a couple of nights ago. And I played an archive of an interview between Jiddu Krishnamurti and Dr. Alan W. Anderson. This information, though it's outside the box and probably something that you never heard before, or if you are familiar with Krishnamurti, then you may very well agree that he was a person devoted, lifelong devotion we're speaking about here, to allowing man to discover his true nature. He did this by observing and studying the problems that man has intrinsically, the way the planet is set up, the way we are led down a particular path, a belief system. We call it now, today, the matrix, or we call it being inside the box. And Krishnamurti had a lot to say in regard to how man could free himself, or herself, I should say, mankind, from tyranny and from disinformation, from ignorance, and ignorance about many different things, whether you're speaking about the physical body, the mind, and its various thought forms and the way it functions according to the programming it's undergone. And, of course, last but not least, in fact, the most important or the most significant aspect of who we are relates to who we are spiritually and our connection with the creation and thus the creator. This individual, this magnificent being that we refer to so casually as God. If you just contemplate the size of the universe, which you cannot even come close to imagining, then you have to understand that intrinsically the creator is even all the more magnificent. And I don't just mean in terms of size or space or area, but the infinite wisdom, the infinite knowledge beyond our comprehension, and probably over the course of many lifetimes, we could not even begin to understand all there is to understand about the universe. And yet, we don't even look at in that direction. We don't see as a collective body of beings that we're all connected to each other, and that what one does to another impacts the whole. We shirk our responsibilities. We seek to blame others for our own mistakes and then blindly accept the alleged or the so-called solutions presented to us by people we don't even know. Imagine the insanity of that. And yet that is what we could say is the way of the world. And so on tonight's show, we're going to listen to Krishnamurti. It's a lofty topic, I'll admit that. And by design, I've brought it to the show tonight to share it with you, because we need to hear lofty thoughts. We need to cast our ideas and our creativity upon fertile grounds if we're going to see results. And it begins with each one of us. Krishnamurti is not, in his talk, he's not going to be poo-pooing religion as far as a particular faith is concerned, but he's talking about the way it's organized and the way you are controlled through the various mechanisms that have been devised for that very purpose. It's a contradiction to the free will that the Creator has given to us. And again, I say, that's the way of the world.
Oh,
Through the words and music of Earth, Wind, and Fire, producer Charles Stepney, and the writing of one Maurice White, the singing of Maurice White, also Philip Bailey, and Earth, Wind, and Fire, we just got the solution to our problems in a very abstract way, but nonetheless, those words say quite a bit. Now, I want to take this opportunity, as I mentioned, to go into the discussion involving Krishnamurti and also Dr. Alan Anderson. They're going to be speaking about religion, authority, and education. And this is the first part of two talks on this. We're just going to be listening to about an hour of this. And I urge you, you really pay attention to what is being said. Open your hearts and try to just take this in for what it's worth. This is Krishnamurti and Dr. Alan Anderson.
Mr. Krishnamurti, we were talking last time together about death in the context of living and love. And as I remember, just as we came to the close of what we were discussing, we thought it would be good to pursue this in terms of a further inquiry into education. What really goes on between teacher and student when they begin looking together, and what are the traps that immediately appear and shock? You mentioned the terror of death, not simply externally, but internally in relation to thought. And it seemed to me perhaps it would be a splendid thing if we just continued that and went deeper into it.
So I would like to ask why we are educated at all. What is the meaning of this education that people receive? Apparently, they don't understand a thing of life. They don't understand fear, pleasure, the whole thing that we have discussed, and the ultimate fear of death and the terror of not being. Is it that we have become so utterly materialistic that we're only concerned with good jobs, money, pleasure, and superficial amusements, entertainments, whether they be religious or football? Is it that that our whole nature and structure has become so utterly meaningless? And when we are educated to that, and to suddenly face something real, is terrifying. And as we were saying yesterday, we are not educated to look at ourselves. We are not educated to understand the whole business of living. We are not educated to look and see what happens if we face death. So I was wondering, as we came along this morning, religion, which we are going to discuss anyhow, has become merely not only a divisive process, but also utterly meaningless. Maybe 2,000 years as Christianity, or 3, 5 as Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on, it has lost its substance. And we never inquire into what is religion, what is education, what is living, what is dying, you know, the whole business of it. We never ask, what is it all about? And when we do ask, we say, well, life has very little meaning. And it has very little meaning as we live. And so we escape into all kinds of fantastic, romantic nonsense, which has no reason, which is not we can't discuss or logically inquire, but is mere escape from this utter emptiness that one, a life that one leads. I don't know if you saw the other day, a group of people adoring a human being. And that's doing most fantastic things. And that's what they call religion. That's what they call God. They seem to have lost all reason. Reason, apparently, has no meaning anymore either.
I did see a documentary that was actually put on by this station, in which the whole meeting operation was being portrayed between the public and this individual in this young 15-year-old guru, Maharaji.
Oh, sir, this, sir.
And it was
disgusting.
It was extraordinary. Amazing. And it was, in many respects, revolting.
And that's what they call religion. So, shall we begin with the religion, go on?
Yes, I think it would be a splendid thing to do.
All right, sir. No, actually, man has always wanted or tried to find out something beyond the everyday living, everyday routine, everyday pleasures, every activity of thought. He wanted something much more. I don't know if you have been to India. I do not know if you've been to villages. They put a little stone under a tree, put some marking on it. Next day they have flowers, and the fourth day people are there. It has become divinity. It has become something religious. That same principle is continued in the cathedrals. It's exactly the same thing when you mass and all the rituals in India, and all that. It begins there. The desire for human beings to find something more than what thought has put together. Not being able to find it, they romanticize it. They create symbols. Or somebody who has got a little bit of this, they worship. And around that they do all kinds of rituals, Indian puja, you know, all that business goes on. And that's called religion. Which has absolutely nothing to do with behavior, with our daily life. So, seeing all this, both in the West and the East, in the world of Islam, in the world of Hindu Buddhism and all that, it's the same principle going on. Worshipping an image which they have created, whether it's the Buddha or Jesus or Christ, it is the human mind that has created the image.
Oh, yes. Oh, certainly.
And they worship the image which is their own. Mm-hmm. In other words, they are worshipping themselves.
And the division, the split, grows wider. Yes.
So religion, when one asks, what is religion? Obviously, one must negate, in the sense, not brutally cut off, understand all this. And so negate all the religions. Negate the religion of India and the multiple gods and goddesses, and here the religion of Christianity, which is an image which they have created, which is idolatry. They might not like to call it idolatry, but it is. It's an idolatry of the mind. The mind has created the ideal, and the mind, through the hand, created the statue, the cross, and so on and so on. So, if one really puts all that aside, the belief, the superstition, the worship of the person, worship of an idea, and the rituals and the tradition, all that, if one can do it, and one must do it to find out.
Exactly. There's a point of terror here that is many, many faceted, it seems to me. It has so many, many different mirrors that it holds up to one's own dysfunction. To reach the place where one is willing to begin at the point where he makes this negation in order to find out, he thinks very often that he's being required to assume something in advance in order to make the negation. And therefore he balks at that, and he won't do it.
No, because the brain needs security. Otherwise it can't function.
That's right.
So it finds security in a belief, in an image, in rituals, in the propaganda of 2,000 or 5,000 years. And there is a sense of safety, comfort, security, well-being. Somebody is looking after the image of somebody greater than me who is looking after my inwardly, he's responsible, all that. So when you are asking a human being to negate all that, he's faced with immense sense of danger. Immense sense of, he becomes panicked.
Exactly.
So to see all that, to see the absurdity of all the present religions, the utter meaninglessness of it all, and to face being totally insecure and not be frightened.
I sense a trick that one can play on himself right here.
Again, I'm
very grateful to you that we're exploring together this pathology.
Yes.
And in its various facets. One can begin with the notion that he's going to make this negation in order to attain to something better.
No, that's not negation.
And that's not negation at all.
The negation is to deny what is false, not knowing what is, what is true.
Yes.
To see the false in the false, and to see the truth in the false. And it is the truth that denies the false. You don't deny the false, but you see what is false. And the very seeing of what is false is the truth.
Yes, of course.
That denies, that sweeps away all this. I don't know if I make myself clear.
Well, I had a very interesting experience in class yesterday. I had given the class an assignment. I think I mentioned this in the conversation we had yesterday. I'd given the class an assignment to go and look at the tree. So, in effect, I'm making a report as to what happened after they came back. Well, one young woman described what happened to her. And she described it in such a way that the class was convinced, and I was convinced, that there was no blockage of her looking between herself and this tree. She was calmly ecstatic in her report. That sounds like a curious juxtaposition of words, but it seems to me to be correct. But then I asked her a question. And I said, well, now, were you thinking of yourself as looking at this tree? And she hesitated. Mind you, she'd already gone through this whole statement, which was very beautifully undertaken. And I come along playing the role of the serpent in the garden, you see. and I said, well, now, might it not have been the case that any time when you were doing this, that you thought of yourself looking at the tree. And with this hesitation, she began to fall more and more out of her own act. Well, we had a look at that. She and I and the class, we all had a look at what she was doing. Finally, she turned around and said, well, the reason that I stopped was not because of what went on between me and the tree. I'm very clear about that. It's because I'm in class now, and I'm thinking that I ought to say the right thing. And so I've gone and ruined the whole thing. it was a revelation not only to her, but you could see with respect to the faces all around the room that we're all involved in this nonsense.
Yes, sir.
And her shock that she could so betray this relationship that she'd had in doing her exercise in just a couple of words was
very revealing.
It was extremely revealing, but at the same time desperately hard to believe that anybody would do such a thing to himself. Yes, please go on.
So, sir, that's it. Negation can only take place when the mind sees the false. The very perception of the false is a negation of the false. And when you see the religions based on miracles, based on personal worship, based on the fear that you yourself, your own life is so shoddy, empty, meaningless, and it is so transient. Mm-hmm. You're gone in a few years, and the mind creates the image which is eternal, which is marvelous, which is the beautiful, the heaven, and identifies with it and worships it. Because it needs a sense of security, deeply. Mm-hmm. And it has created all these superficial nonsense, a circus. It is a circus.
Oh, yes.
So can the mind observe this phenomenon? Mm-hmm. And see its own demand for security, comfort, safety, permanency, and deny all that. Deny in the sense, see how the brain, thought, creates the sense of permanency. Mm-hmm. Eternality or whatever you like to call it. Mm-hmm. And to see all that. Therefore, one has to go much more deeply, I think, into the question of thought. Because both in the West and the East, thought has become the most important movement in life. Right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Thought, which has created this marvelous world of technology, marvelous world of science and all that, and thought which has created the religions. Mm-hmm. All the marvelous chants, both the Gregorian and the Sanskrit chants. Thought which has built these beautiful cathedrals. Thought which has made images of the saviors, the masters, the gurus, the father image. Unless one really understands thought, what is thinking, we will still play the same game in a different field.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
And look what is happening in this country. These gurus come from India. They shave their head, put on the Indian dress, little tuft of hair hanging down, and repeat endlessly what somebody has said. A new guru. They have had old gurus, the priests.
Oh, yeah.
The Catholic, the Protestant. And they have denied them, but accept the others. You follow?
Yes.
The others are as dead as the old ones. Because they're just repeating tradition. Mm-hmm. Traditionally repeating how to sit, how to shave, how to meditate, how to hold your head, breathe. And finally obey what the old guru says, or the young guru says. Which is exactly what took place in the Catholic world, in the Protestant, you follow? Mm-hmm. They deny that and yet accept the other. Because they want security. They want somebody to tell them what to do, what to think. Never how to think.
No, this raises a question that I hope we can explore together, that concerns the word experience.
That's another word.
It's amazing how often in these times this word crops up to represent something that I desperately need, which somehow lies outside myself. I need the experience of an awakening.
Yeah.
It isn't an awakening that I need, apparently. It's an experience of this awakening. the whole idea of religion as experience seems to me to need very, very careful thought, very, very careful penetration.
Question.
Very careful penetration.
Sir, if I may ask, why do we demand experience? Why is this craving for experience? We have sexual experiences of every kind, don't we?
Yes.
As we live. Mm-hmm. Insults, flattery, happenings, incidents, influences, what people say, don't say, we read a book that, and so on, so on. We are experiencing all the time. Mm-hmm. We are bored with that. And we say, we go to somebody who will give me the experience of God.
Yes, that's precisely what's claimed.
Yeah. Now, what is involved in that? What is involved in experience, in the demand for experience, and the experiencing of that demand? I experience what that guru or master or somebody tells me. How do I know it is real? And I say, I recognize it. Hmm? Don't I say? Mm-hmm. Look, I experience something. And I can only know that I've experienced it only when I have recognized it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Recognition implies I've already known.
Recognize. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm experiencing what I've already known. Therefore, it's nothing new. I don't know.
Yes, you're making yourself very, very clear.
So, all they are doing is a self-deception.
Mm-hmm. It is actually lusted after.
That's all. Good level. Oh, yes.
Yes. The drive for it is extraordinary. I've seen it in many, many students who will go to extraordinary austerities. Really.
Oh, I've noticed.
We sometimes think that that young people today are very loose in their behavior. Well, some are, but what's so new about that? That's been going on since time out of mind. I think that what is rarely seen is that many, many young persons today are extremely serious about acquiring something that someone possesses that they don't have. And if someone claims to have it, naively, they're on their way. And they'll go through any number of cartwheels. They'll stand on their head indefinitely
I've seen all.
Yes, which is called an experience as such.
That's why one has to be very careful, as you pointed out, sir, to explore this world and to see why the mind, why a human being demands more experience when he's... His whole life is a vast experience with which he's so bored. Mm-hmm. He thinks this is a new experience. Mm-hmm. But to experience the new, how can the mind recognize it as the new? And this is already known it. I don't know if I...
Yes. And there's something very remarkable here in terms of what you said earlier. In other previous conversations that we've had, in the recognition of what is called the new, the linkage with old thought, old image, establishes the notion that there's something gradual in the transition.
Yes.
That there really is some kind of genuine link here with where I am now and where I was before. Now I become the next guru who goes out and teaches the person how gradually to undertake this discipline.
Yes, sir.
And it never stops. No, I do see that. It's amazing. Driving down in the car this morning, I was thinking about the whole business of chant that you mentioned, the beauty of it all. And since this is related to experience as such, I thought maybe we could examine the aesthetics in terms of where this self-trapping lies in it. And of course, I thought of Sanskrit and that beautiful invocation that is chanted to the Upanishad, the Isha, Purnam Adar, Purnam Idam, Purnat Purnam Udachyate, Purnasya Purnam, and it goes on. And I said to myself, if one would attend to those words, there's the echo of the abiding through the whole thing, through that whole glorious cadence. And yet, within it, there's the radical occasion to fall into a euphoria.
Yes, sir.
And somnolence takes over. But it's within the very same. And I said to myself, well, maybe Mr. Krishnamurti would say a word about the relation of beauty to this in terms of one's own relation to the beautiful, when that relation is not seen for what it is. Since there's a narcosis present that I can generate, it isn't in those words. And yet we think that the language must be at fault. There must be something demonically hypnotic about this. We do. And then religious groups will separate themselves totally from all this. Oh, well, we had a period in Europe when Protestants, Calvinists wouldn't allow an organ. No music.
No music.
Because music is seductive.
It's music.
I'm not the self-seducer. It's the music's fault. Yeah, let's look at that.
That is just... It's as we were saying the other day, sir, beauty can only be when there is the total abandonment of the self. Mm. Complete emptying the consciousness of its content, which is the me. Mm. Then there is a beauty which is something entirely different from the pictures, chants, all that. Mm. And probably most of these young people, and also the older people, seek beauty in that sense through the trappings of the church, through chants, through reading a beautiful, the Old Testament, with all its beautiful words and images and all that. And that gives them a sense of deep satisfaction. In other words, sir, what they are seeking is really gratification. True beauty. Mm-hmm. Beauty of word, beauty of chant, beauty of all the robes and the incense and the light of the coming through those marvelous piece of color. You've seen it all in cathedrals. Notre Dame and and it gives them a sense of sacredness, sense of feeling happy, relieved. At last there is a place where I can go and meditate, be quiet, get into contact with something. Mm-hmm. And when you come along, say, look, all that's all rubbish. It's no meaning. What has meaning is how you live in your daily life.
Yes, sir.
Then they throw a brick at you.
Of course, it's like taking food away from a starving dog.
Exactly. So, this is the whole point, sir. Experience is a trap. And all the people want this strange experience which the gurus think they have.
Which is always called the knowledge. Interesting.
Yeah, very, very.
Isn't it? It's always called the knowledge. Yes. Of course, I was thinking of our previous conversations about this self-transformation. That is not dependent on knowledge.
Of course not.
Not dependent on time.
No.
And eminently requires responsibility.
You see, and also, sir, we don't want to work. We work very strenuously in earning a livelihood. Hmm? Look what we do. Year after year after year, day after day, day after day. The brutality, the ugliness of all that. But here, inwardly, psychologically, we don't want to work. We're too lazy. Let the other fellow work. Perhaps he has worked. And perhaps he'll give me something. But I don't say, I'm going to find out. I'll deny the whole thing and find out.
No, the assumption is that the priest's business is to have worked in order to know so that I am relieved of that task, or if I didn't come into the world with enough marbles, then all I need do is simply follow his instructions, and it's his fault if he gets it messed up.
Yeah, and we never shall ask the man who says, I know, I have experience, what do you know?
Exactly.
What have you experienced? What do you know? When you say, I know, you only know something which is dead, which is gone, which is finished, which is the power. You can't know something that's living. Huh. You follow, sir?
Yes.
A living thing, you can never know. It's moving. It is never the same. And so I can never say, I know my wife. Or my husband, my children. Because they're living human beings. But these fellows come along, from India especially, and they say, well, I know, I've experienced, I have knowledge, I will give it to you. And I say, what impudence. You follow, sir?
Yes.
What callous indifference. That you know and I don't know. And what do you know?
It's amazing what's been going on in terms of the relation between men on the one hand and women on the other, or man and woman with respect to this, because a whole mythology has grown up about this. For instance, woman, we say, our sex says, woman is mysterious. And never is this understood in terms of the freshness of life, which includes everything, not just woman. Now we have an idea that woman is mysterious. So we're talking about something in terms of an essence, which has nothing to do with existence.
Exactly.
Isn't that what you're...
That's your
situation. Yes, yes, I... Goodness me. And as you said earlier, we're actually taught this. This is all in books. This is all in the conversations that go on in classrooms.
So that's why I feel education is destroying people as it is now. It has become a tragedy. If I had a son, which I have not, thank God, I would say, where am I to educate him? What am I to know with him? To make him like the rest of the group? Like the rest of the community? Thought, memories, accept, obey, You follow, sir? All the things that are going on. And when you are faced with that, as many people are now, they are faced with this problem.
Oh, they are, yes. Yes, there's no question about that.
And so we say, look, let's start a school. Which we have in India, which we're going to do in California at Oahu. We're going to do that. Let's start a school where we think totally differently, where we are taught differently. Not just the routine, to accept or to deny, react, you know, the whole thing. So from that arises another question. Why does the mind obey? I obey the laws of the country. I obey keeping to the left side of the road or right side of the road. I obey what the doctor tells me. Obey. I'm careful what he tells me. If I'm little, personally, I don't go near doctors. If I do, I'm very careful. I listen very careful what they have to say. I'm watchful. I don't accept immediately this or that. But politically, in a so-called democratic world, they won't accept a tyrant. Right?
Mm-hmm. No, they won't accept.
They say, no authority, freedom. Mm-hmm. But spiritually, inwardly, they accept every Tom, Dick, and Harry. Mm-hmm. Especially when they come from India.
Oh, yes.
The other day, I turned on with London BBC, and there was a man interviewing a certain group of people. And the boy and the girl said, we obey entirely what our guru says. I said. And the interviewer said, will he tell you to marry? If he tells me, I'll marry. If he tells me I must stop, I will stop. Far. Just a slave. You understand, sir? And yet this very same person would object to political tyranny.
Absurd.
You?
Yes.
There he will accept the tyranny of a petty little guru with his fanciful ideas. And he will reject politically a tyranny or a dictatorship. So, why does the mind divide life into accepting authority in one way, in one direction, and deny it in another? And what is the importance of authority? That is, the word authority, as you know, means the one who originates.
Author. Yes.
And these priests, gurus, leaders, spiritual preachers, what have they originated? They are repeating tradition, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Precisely.
And tradition, whether it's from the Zen tradition, the Chinese tradition, or Hindu, is a dead thing. And these people are perpetuating the dead thing. The other day I saw a man. He was explaining how to meditate. Put your hands here, close your eyes. And
yes, that's the one I saw.
And do this, that, and the other. I said, God.
It was appalling. It was appalling.
And people accepted your sister.
And on the same thing, there was this woman who had to run out of money and every blessed thing, and she had nowhere to go to sleep and so forth, and hysterically she was saying, I'm in line, I've got all these people ahead of me, but I must have this knowledge. I must have this knowledge. The hysteria of it, the desperation of it.
That's why, sir, what is behind this acceptance of authority? You understand? The authority of law, the authority of the policeman, the authority of the priest, the authority of these gurus. What is behind this acceptance of authority? Is it fear? Fear of going wrong spiritually? Of not doing the right thing in order to gain enlightenment, knowledge, the super consciousness, whatever it is? Is it fear? Or is it a sense of despair? A sense of utter loneliness, utter ignorance. I'm using the word ignorance in the deeper sense of
yes,
the word.
Yes, I follow.
Which makes me say, there is a man there who says he knows, I'll accept him. I don't reason. You follow, sir? I don't say, what do you know? What do you bring to us, give to your own tradition from India? Who cares? You're bringing something dead, nothing original. You follow, sir? Nothing real. But repeat what others have done, which in India themselves are throwing out.
Yes, I was just thinking of Tennyson's lines that apropos of this, though in a different context when he wrote it. There's not to reason why, there's but to do and die.
The growth.
Yeah.
So what is behind this acceptance of authority?
It's interesting that the word authority is radically related to the self.
Yes.
Autos, the self. There is this sensed, gaping void through the division.
Yes, sir, that's just.
Through the division. And that immediately opens up a hunger, doesn't it? And my projection of my meal, I've run madly to.
You see this? When you see this, you want to cry. You follow, sir?
Yes.
And all these young people going to these gurus, shaving their head, dressing in Indian dress, dancing in the streets, and you know, fantastic things they're doing. All on a tradition which is dead. All tradition is dead. You follow, like, and what was, when you see that, you say, my God, what is happening? So I go back and ask, why do we accept? Why are we influenced by these people? Why are we influenced when there is a constant repetition in a commercial, buy this, buy this, buy this? It's the same as that. You follow, sir?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why do we accept? The child accepts. I can understand that. Mm. Poor thing, he doesn't know anything. It needs security. It needs a mother. It needs a care. It needs a protection. It needs for it to sit in your lap and be, you follow, affectionate, kind, gentle, that it needs that. Mm. Is it they think the guru gives him all this? Through their words, through their rituals, through their repetition, through their absurd disciplines. You follow? Sense of acceptance as I accept my mother, a child. I accept that in order to be comfortable, in order to feel at last something after me.
This relates to what you said in a previous conversation when we looked into fear. The reaction of the infant is a reaction with no intermediary of any kind of his own contrivance. He simply recognizes that he has a need. And this is not an imagined want. It is a radical need. He needs to feed. He needs to be affectionately
of course, sir,
held.
Of course.
the transition from that to the point where one, as he gets older, begins to think about the source of the meeting of that need, emerges as the image,
yes,
that is interposed between the sense of danger and the immediate action. So, if I'm understanding you correctly, there's a deflection here from the radical purity of act.
That's right.
And I've done that myself. I have done that myself. It isn't because of anything that I was told that actually coerced me to do it, even though what you say is true. We are continually invited. It's a kind of siren-like call that comes to us throughout the entire culture, in all cultures, to start that stuff.
So that's what I want to get at. Why is it that we accept authority? In the democratic world, politically, we would shun any dictator. Mm-hmm. But yet, religiously, they're all dictators. And why do we accept? Why do I accept the priest as an intermediary to something which he says he knows? And so it shows, sir, we stop reasoning. Politically, we reason. We see how important it is to be free. Free speech, free, everything free, as much as possible. We never think freedom is necessary here. Spiritually, we don't feel the necessity of freedom. And therefore, we accept it. Any Tom, Dick, and Harry is horrifying. The most, I've seen intellectuals, professors, scientists falling for all this trash. Because they have reasoned in the scientific world and are weary of reasoning. And here at last, I can sit back, not reason, be told, be comfortable, be happy. I'll do all the work for you. You don't have to do anything. I'll take you over the river. You follow?
Oh, yes.
And I'm delighted. So, we accept where there is ignorance, where reason doesn't function, where intelligence is in abeyance, and you need all that, freedom, intelligence, reasoning, in with regard to real spiritual matters. Otherwise, what? Some guru comes along and tells you what to do, and you repeat what he does. You follow how destructive it is?
The thing,
how degenerate it is, that's what's happening.
Endlessly.
I don't think these gurus realize what they are doing.
No.
They're encouraging degeneracy.
Well, they represent
a chain
of the same.
Exactly. So can we, so this brings up a very important question. Can we educate, can there be an education in which there is no authority whatsoever?
I must say yes to that in terms of the experience that I had in class yesterday. It was a tremendous shock to the students when they suspended their disbelief for a moment, just to see whether I meant it when I said, now, we must do this together. Not you're doing what I say to do.
Do it to walk together.
We will do this together.
Share it together.
Right. You will question, and I will question, and we'll try to grasp as we go along without trying. And I went into the business about, let's not have this shoddy little thing trying.
Quite right.
That took a little while. That increased the shock because the students who have been, to their own great satisfaction, what you'd call devoted, those who do their work, who make effort, are suddenly finding out that this man has come into the room and he's giving trying a bad press. This does seem to turn the thing completely upside down. But they showed courage in the sense that they gave it
quite
a little attention before beginning the true act of attention. That's why I was using courage there, because it's a preliminary to that. I've quite followed you when you have raised the question about the relation of courage to the pure act of attention. It seems to me that that's not where it belongs.
No.
But they did get it up for this preliminary step. But then we ran into this what I think I called in an earlier conversation, dropping a stitch, where they really saw this abyss. They were alert enough to stand over the precipice. And that caused them to freeze. And it's that moment that seems to me absolutely decisive.
Yes.
That it's almost like one sees in terms of events. Objective events. I remember reading the Spanish philosopher Ortega, who spoke of events that tremble back and forth before the thing actually tumbles into itself. Well, that was happening in the room, but it was like water that moved up to the lip of the cup and couldn't quite spill over. I've spoken about this at some length because I wanted to describe to you a real situation, what was actually happening.
I was going to say, sir, I've connected with very many schools for 40 years and more. And when one talks to the students about freedom and authority and acceptance, they're completely lost.
Yes.
They want to be slaves. My father says this, I must do this. Or my father says I won't do that. It's the same.
Exactly. Do you think in our next conversation we could look at that moment of hesitation?
Yes, sir.
It seems to me so terribly critical for education itself. Wonderful.
And that is the discussion between Jiddu Krishnamurti and Dr. Alan W. Anderson. Very enlightening if you keep an open mind. There was no mention of faith in this discourse, and what I'm attempting to do right now, folks, is to summarize what we heard here in as few sentences as possible, so that you can consider what was said in light of where the responsibility lies. He's asking this rhetorical question: why do we so readily accept authority? especially when those that claim the authority are actually doing the very things that we ourselves, who are searching for solutions to the world's problems, want to avoid by necessity. In past shows, Krishnamurti discussed the issue of the true nature of man and in relationship to knowledge. And when one says, I know this, or I experience that, we're living in the past. I myself am guilty of this. I talk about my experience. And we could take that a step further, and there are those that listen to my sharing of my experiences or my guests' experiences or the callers into the show's experience. And somehow that in and of itself is not meeting the muster of the listening audience, that somehow we have to present further evidence. Keep in mind that I often encourage you not to believe what I'm saying. I'm not asking anyone to believe a word I'm saying. You're presuming that, number one, what I'm telling you is true. Number two, that it's scientifically accurate or can be forensically demonstrated. And in many cases, that is the case. But why is it that I, who bring you the information, now have to meet this special requirement? Krishnamurti talked about others doing the work for you. Let me see what I can get this person to do on my behalf. I might get something for free. I might not have to lift a finger. You see, that's the matrix that we're captured in, where we do not take responsibility for what we do, for who we are being. He describes in the process of doing, you are being, you are a human being. And any attention that you focus on things of the past as a traditional pathway or a belief system or acceptable means at doing things, you're going to keep repeating the same mistakes, because the traditions and the customs and the rituals and the seals, all these different aspects he described, keep it compartmentalized, keep it within a boundary, sort of like prison walls or a barbed wire fence with razor at the top, razor wire pointed in the direction to keep you inside the space, you see, confined, imprisoned in your physical actions, imprisoned in your thoughts, and totally cut off from your true essence, which is your spirituality. And he's talking about the different pathways that are readily accepted, and the untruths or the falsehoods, which he said are to recognize that's a truth. It's true that that is false, is what he's saying. It's not gibberish. If you step outside the box, it makes a whole lot of sense. In fact, it shows us the things that we do, the things that we readily accept without questioning, that are actually a hindrance to our achieving some semblance of a higher consciousness and solutions to the world's problems, instead of this incessant regurgitating of the world's problems, as if somehow performing all these insane sequences of acts and events planned and secretive in nature, and yet thrown right into our face for everyone to what? Experience. To have these things happen to us and cause us to go into illusory states of fear, insecurity, always holding on to hope, this ethereal belief that something is going to happen. I'm not talking about faith, which actually requires action on your part. it's not just a declaration. It becomes your MO, your way of operating through life. And it opens this consciousness that you gain, and I've talked about this on past shows, comes from looking within oneself. Now, he didn't go into that in detail. He does in the next part, and I'll be playing that episode probably next Tuesday for anyone who's interested in hearing how to apply this to one's life. But he's already sounded the alarm and told us, look at what's going on. Are you paying attention that this is happening? Because once you understand this and you step outside the box and see that for what it is and how it was accurately described, you won't go back into the box for security, because you'll see that there is no security in illogical thinking or these destructive acts perpetrated upon humanity. And you are a member of humanity. He talks about how these traditions are really, because they're things of the past, that they're dead. They have no life in them. In fact, I've often said on the show that life is a continuous process of creation. You're creating your experiences. You're creating your relationships. You're creating being, your being, and the various states in which you can be. And it's in the individual pursuit of that that you begin to understand how that connects to the whole. You can't see the forest if you can't see the first tree. And understand its reason for existing. Then you begin to become aware of the consciousness that the whole forest has. Humanity is no different. To live healthily and happily and to get fulfillment out of life and to have life be a positive experience, a creative experience, you have to be able to recognize yourself and be willing to face the insecurities, because all these securities have been offered to you, and look at how insecure you feel with what's going on in the world. It's impossible for you to feel that way if what you've been offered, if what you've been taught to believe, if what you've accepted blindly, and the traditions you follow are on the right path. This insanity, this chaos on this planet would not exist. And the corruption and the deceit that goes on in the background while you're being told a completely different story. And it's only in stepping out of the box and looking at it and seeing it for what it is that you'll immediately recognize that the truth is that those things are false. And now you've discovered the reason why you must look elsewhere. And it begins by looking within, as I've said so many times. I don't mean to sound like I'm preaching. If I do sound that way, so be it, I guess. But we do offer solutions. Keep in mind that this recording was made in 1974, 36, going on 37 years ago. These words still ring true today. As Krishnamurti was talking, I was thinking about how, and they mentioned children, was thinking about how children are controlled through the educational system. We talked about on past shows that people live in a state of expectation that their actions, their doings in life are going to be either rewarded or punished. And school begins with a bell, usually announcing that All the students should be in the classroom. School is beginning. One would think that it's just an informal, subtle way of reminding everyone that school has begun. Yet, if you are in your seat prior to that bell ringing, you are rewarded. And if you are late and get to your seat after the bell has rung, you are punished. You see, we're taught that, even though no one ever explained that to you, other than you have to be in your seat before the bell rings. So you're taught a rule which really is presented as keeping order, yet it sets the stage for the two paradigms to exist and be a source of control just by its very existence. We have all sorts of frequency control. I've talked about that on many shows, many shows over the past 4 years. And we're experiencing frequency control right now with earthquakes and catastrophic events. We're not being told the truth about many of those things. Of course, tomorrow night, we'll be discussing those issues with my guests, Ken Adachi and Z.S. Livingstone. We're going to talk about, I'm sure, what's going on in Japan and other parts of the world. Lots of earthquakes going on. Do we go into fear? Do we keep going back down that path? Or do we begin to look for our inner power, our God-given power? I know of, not all by name, but I know of the existence of 574 planets that are working together. And I would have to presume that those planets, as far as being on any one of those 574 planets, have experienced things similar to what we're experiencing on Earth, but they've transcended that right now. They see the insanity of war, yet they understand the necessity to protect themselves, to be able to defend themselves from forces bent on controlling anything that comes into their path. As something that's been going on for countless eons of time throughout the universe. And it's a reality of existence. If you are in the universe, you are going to experience things that are going on in the universe. It's quite simple. Science and NASA would tell us otherwise, that there is no place to experience anything other than here on planet Earth. Or you get these ridiculous stories that they made radio contact with somebody. I'm not saying that that doesn't go on. That's been going on for decades. What I'm speaking about, though, is this insanity. When a planet agrees to work, when a group of people from a particular planet agree to work with others from hundreds of other planets, there must be a mean consciousness that has developed, an awareness of spirituality and mankind's relationship to the Creator and to the creation. And so one's activity should be to honor those things that give life, not the things designed to take it away, to destroy it, to plunder and steal and rape it. That's the reality we have. Why would you accept that as the end all or the solution? Is it because you're lazy or you're apathetic? I hope not. I hope you didn't stay with the show tonight and feel like you didn't have some aspect of what was said during this interview that meant something to you. I hope it opened your eyes. I hope even possibly your heart, that you can just take a look inside yourself and come into the realization of how powerful we as human beings can be. And it's about being, ultimately. I want to thank you for tuning in tonight. Again, as I mentioned, my guests tomorrow night will be Ken Adachi and Z.S. Livingstone. In the meantime, that wraps up another edition of Evident Footprints. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show over at BBS Radio tonight. I had Seth Hendrick on the sound. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Also, a quick PSA here. Dr. Wayne Pickering will be coming on the broadcast next month in April. We're going to start something a bit different. It's a new addition to the show, and we're calling it Wellness Wednesday. And we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of eating, the nuts and bolts of setting goals and making things really happen in your lives, as well as even addressing some of the spiritual aspects that we discussed this evening. So that's going to be in the month of April. I'm looking forward to a long-running series of interviews and discussions on matters that pertain to us, things that you can empower yourself with. So be sure to be tuning in next month as well. In the meantime, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. Consider what you heard tonight, and we'll see you tomorrow. In the meantime, wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.